Hi, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Svarim Cheddar podcast. On this edition, we're going to be joined by Rabbi Yossi Levine, who's the Rav in the Jewish Center in Manhattan, and who recently completed his dissertation on the Chacham Tzvi. So with that, thank you, Rabbi Yossi, for joining me.
Pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
So why don't you start off telling the listeners a little bit about yourself, about your background, about what you do now?
Sure. I'm originally from Los Angeles, California. I spent some time in Eretz Yisrael after high school learning in Shalavim. I did my undergraduate at Columbia. I studied English. Then I spent a little time teaching for the Lauder Foundation in Central Europe. I came back and did my smicha at Yeshiva University. And then I became the rabbinic intern and assistant rabbi, associate rabbi at the Jewish Center under Rabbi Ari Berman, who was my Rav, my Rebbe, my teacher, my mentor. And then when he left for Eretz Yisrael, I became the rabbi of the Jewish Center, where I've been since 2004. Around 8 years ago, I went back to Yeshiva, back to the Bernard Revel Graduate School to start a work on a PhD. And I studied early modern Jewish history. And as you just mentioned, last year completed my dissertation on Chacham Tzvi.
Wow. So I'm curious what drew you to Chacham Tzvi, especially. It's interesting. I don't know if it's coincidence that one of your predecessors at the Jewish Center, Rabbi Jacob J. Schachter, we had on, was Yaakov Emden. So you're doing the father. I don't know if that has anything to do with it, but I'm just curious how you got to Chacham Tzvi.
It's a great question. Yeah, we try to keep it in the family at the Jewish Center. They say doctoral dissertation topic, you don't find your topic, the topic finds you. So I was interested in this period, the early modern period, and specifically, this time period, 17th, 18th century, is really fertile ground. And I was looking for someone to write a biography about. So among the Achronim, it's actually fascinating to note that there are very few meaningful biographies. The early modern period and beyond, it's like, did you ever see a real biography of the Rama? Do you ever see a real biography of the Shach, the Magen Avraham?
The Rama, there is. Ashtabio, Ash Yosef has a biography. That one, but in general, yes. You're right. There's nothing. There's very little.
Yeah, it was his doctoral dissertation. Yeah. So virtually nothing. So one of the big targets, that was out there and available that no one had really seriously written about was Chacham Tzvi. So it made sense to me. Also, I'll just say as a dissertation topic, as opposed to a life works and biography topic, part of what made it alluring was that it seemed manageable. Yaakov Emden, he wrote dozens and dozens of Sfarim, and to even begin to scratch the surface would be just, crazy. Chacham Tzvi wrote two books. He wrote a Perush on the Taz's commentary to Choshen Mishpat, and he wrote a book of Shailos and Tshuvos. So there's letters, there's correspondence, there's lots of other material, but it seemed like a manageable project, and Baruch Hashem it was.
Yeah, I always think that, see people doing dissertations on Gedolim and various things. People wrote you have to work with all the writings, and it's like if they have so much, how do you get that done? I always think that. I mean, maybe that's why J.J. Schachter's thing is the 790 pages or whatever it is. I mean,
that's on one book,
right?
Primarily.
Yeah. So let's start with a biography of the Chacham Tzvi. People may not know. Just a background and just a quick synopsis of his life.
Quick synopsis. Okay. So happy to return to any of these pieces if they're of interest later on. But al regel achas, Chacham Tzvi. There's a lot of debate actually about his birth date, but we think 1658 is the right date. He's born in Moravia in 1658 to a prominent family of Ashkenazic Rabbanim, and he grows up back and forth between Budapest, present-day Budapest, was called Alt-Offen at the time, and Sfarad, like the Ottoman Empire. So he learned with his maternal grandfather, Ephraim HaKohen, the author of the Shaar Ephraim in Budapest, but he also, his father sent him to learn in the Sephardic yeshivas, which he thought would be a better education for him in Salonika and in Constantinople, Istanbul, as it was called, depending on the time. So he spent his youth immersed in that Sephardic world. He was married. We know very little about his first marriage. He was married and had a small child. In 1686, he was in Budapest, and the Austrian army attacked. The city of Altofen was under the control of the Ottomans at the time. The Austrian army attacked, and the Jewish community suffered terribly. It wasn't a pogrom, it was just a military conflict, but the Jewish community was caught in the middle of it. Chacham Tzvi's wife and his daughter were killed, and his parents were taken captive, and he escaped. He made it to Sarajevo. He became the Rav in the Sephardic community, the only community of Sarajevo at the time. We know very little about his time there. He spent a few years in Sarajevo, and then he married the daughter-in-law of the chief rabbi of Altona Hamburg Wandsbek, the daughter of Rav Zalman Newmark Mirals, and he made his way around 1690 to Altona. There were times when the Jewish community was not permitted to live in Hamburg. They can only do business there. There are three communities, and they had amalgamated into what was became a famous triple community, the Ashkenazi communities of Altona Hamburg Wandsbek, Altona, and Wandsbek were functionally suburbs of the port city of Hamburg. And Chacham Tzvi learned in a klois. You know, klois is like a privately sponsored kollel. He was in kollel, you know, for many years. People appreciated that he was a gadol b'Tora, and they would write to him. He'd write back, and you know, his reputation began to grow. 1706, his father-in-law passed away, and they asked Chacham Tzvi if he would be the chief rabbi to succeed his father-in-law. But it wasn't so obvious to everyone that he should be the chief rabbi. So in Hamburg and Wandsbek, they were all good with it, and in Altona there was a debate. So it's a recipe for disaster, and I don't recommend that any communities do this, but they came up with the pshara. There were two factions in Altona. One wanted Chacham Tzvi to be the rabbi, and one wanted another rav called Meir Rotenberg, not to be confused with the Maharam Rotenberg from, you know, the several hundred years earlier. So they split it, and they decided to do a rotation, 6 months, 6 months. So it was a disaster, and it lasted a very short time, and we could talk about this other fellow that he co-officiated with. It wasn't a good setup. This went on for a few years. 1710, he was called on to become the chief rabbi of the Ashkenazic community in Amsterdam. Ashkenazic community in Amsterdam was one of the most desirable positions in Rabbanus in the entire universe. It wasn't easy to be a Jew in 1710 in most places in the world. One of the best places in the world to be a Jew was in Amsterdam, economically, socially, and religiously, all the miles. We could talk more about it later. You know, Bisman Hazeh, the community wants to hire a rav, so they have prabhas. They didn't have prabhas, but we knew that it wasn't like a slam dunk. It wasn't like there was one candidate. There are actually four candidates. It's really fascinating. Who did he beat out to be the Rav of the Ashkenazic community of Amsterdam? So one fellow was Michel of Berlin. We don't know too much about, but a very important Talmud Chacham in Berlin. Another was Rav Yaakov Poppers, who you'll know from the Beis Medrash as the author of the Shev Yaakov. And the third you'll know from the Beis Medrash was Rav Yeshua Falk, the Pnei Yeshua. So how good do you have to be to have beaten the Pnei Yeshua for the Rabbanus of Amsterdam? Also, probably for reasons that we could get into, wasn't a huge success. Okay, so they wanted to hire him for 3 years. He wanted to be a rev on the contract for 6 years. They had a whole debate about the contract and the negotiation. He moved. 1710, he became the chief rabbi, and there were some successful pieces of his rabbanus there. But particularly when Nechemiah Chia Chayon arrived in Amsterdam in 1713, things really went south. We could talk more about it. By the very beginning of 1714, that was the end. Chacham Tzvi had to flee. He went briefly to London, and then he went to Poland. He spent the last few years of his life in Poland. We don't know too much about the time in Poland, those intervening years. He was in little communities like Staszów and Opatów. And finally, the last year of his life, the beginning of 1718, he was hired to become the chief rabbi of Lwów, present-day Lemberg, we call it Lwów. And he died just 3-4 months after he became the chief rabbi of Lemberg in 1718, and that's where he was buried.
Okay, great. Thank you. Very, very good synopsis. So let's go back up a little, drill in a couple things. First of all, the story with his first wife and the daughter, I believe Rabbi Yaakov Emden says in Megillah Sefer that a cannonball came in, right?
So just to fill in the gap. So Yaakov Emden is the son of Chacham Tzvi. Yaakov Emden is very prolific author. And one of the books that he wrote was a book called Megillat Sefer. He never published it in his lifetime. It wasn't published until 1896 in Warsaw, you know, more than 100 years after he died in 1776. And Yaakov Emden has this autobiography that tells the story of his life. And functionally, the first quarter of that book is a biography of his father. And a lot of the information that we know about Chacham Tzvi comes from the first 50 pages of Megillat Sefer. So sometimes we have other sources that corroborate the information. Sometimes we have sources that are a little conflicting with the information. And sometimes we have no other sources. So in the case of the siege of Buda, so we know a lot about the siege because it was an important military event in the summer of 1686. We don't know anything more really than the story that Yaakov Emden tells about how his father's first wife and child were killed in that siege. And he writes that a cannonball fell on the house where his Chacham Tzvi's wife and daughter were. Killed them, and Chacham Tzvi was able to escape unscathed.
Right. So a few other things I want to clarify, then ask you about something. First of all, Budapest, like I said, was two different cities at that time, and one part of it was Sephardi, like I said, the Ottomans. Does that have to do with why he was sent to Salonika and to learn in Sephardi lands? Because that's a little bit odd for an Ashkenazi, someone Ashkenazi was, to go learn with the Sephardi yeshiva and to come out with the Sephardi Mahalach HaLimud and all that.
Yeah, it's a great question. We don't really know. We don't really know the answer to the question of why, let's say, Chacham Tzvi's father would have sent his young son to go learn among the Sephardim. Although it is important to note, as you just did, that there weren't too many places. There were some, and we could talk more about them. There weren't too many places where Sephardim and Ashkenazim were living side by side. And even to the extent that they weren't very integrated. And if you read the Tshuvos of the Shaar Ephraim, so you could see that there was already some integration and some involvement between the Sephardic and Ashkenazic communities there. And perhaps that played a role. Very difficult to know. And Chacham Tzvi never said why.
Right, there maybe was, like you said, Amsterdam a little later and then Venice, but Italy was really Italian. They just haven't different, they weren't like Sephardi and Ashkenaz like this. It was a little different.
Exactly.
So, right. The other thing is to get to his famous acronym, Chacham Tzvi. Why is he called Chacham Tzvi? So I actually saw this, and this as a kid when I read Avner Gold's books, which are great for kids. And I think he mentions in there, I think, that it's Chacham Tzvi because it's Tzvi ben Yaakov, and that's where the Yavis is Yaakov ben Tzvi. That's where I remember picking that up from. And Chacham was because you learned in the Sephardi yeshiva. Is all that, you want to talk a little bit about all that?
Yeah, sure. So that is right. Meaning the Yaibitz is Yaakov ben Tzvi. Chacham Tzvi named his son Yaakov after his father, who was named Yaakov. Chacham Tzvi had four girls before he had a boy, and his first boy, the first opportunity he had, his father, we don't know the death of his father, the date of the death of his father is probably a couple of years before, and the first opportunity he named his first son Yaakov, and he even writes, right, that he had that in mind, that his son would be called Yaakov ben Tzvi Yaibitz. As far as the Chacham piece, again, we only know what Yaakov Emden tells us, namely that, in these Sephardic yeshivos, they he adopted the name Chacham, as was the custom them in the Sephardic yeshivas.
Right. Okay. And two other things I just wanted to mention. You mentioned Sarajevo, which is in Bosnia, which is Sephardi, and then Altoona, Hamburg, Wandsbek is Ahu. People may see it in Sfarim as Aleph, Hey, Vav, you know, right? That's how it's written. So to jump back into him, so I guess where should we should pick this up from, I guess when he went to Amsterdam. So he said he got, you know, he competed, so to speak, against these other Rabbanim, and he got the Shteller. So he started off there. So first of all, explain a little bit more. I guess we covered it, but a little bit more about the dispute with the contract, with the money, and what in the world happened over there.
Yeah. So there's actually another dissertation waiting to be written on rabbinic contracts. So we actually have preserved many rabbinic contracts, and sometimes we have preserved, in the case of Chaim Tzvi too, sometimes we have correspondence between the community and the Rav or the rabbinic candidate, as the case may be. And it's fascinating. It's very telling. You know, what were the expectations of the community and what were the expectations of the Rav? So for instance, you know, you could find that in a rabbinic contract, this is going to be your salary for, you know, all the months of the year. And in Nisan and in Tishrei, you're going to get double, because they're working twice as hard, right? Or you know, the Rav says, I'll only take the position if I have, you know, a base medrash to learn it. It's not obvious that a community has a base medrash that's Malay Sfarim. It's like, who knows where you could end up. So we have some of this back and forth between the Ashkenazi community in Amsterdam and Chacham Tzvi. Look, Chacham Tzvi had a big family to support at the time. He had something like 10 children, he was being asked to relocate and to do a job that was very different from, you know, the job he had been doing up until that time. So it, you know, he came in with his own set of expectations. The community had its own set of expectations. One word you could use to describe Chacham Tzvi might be uncompromising. So he had his vision of what the contract would look like. They had their vision, they ended up with a three-year contract. And by like the second year, they had already decided, you know, we don't want to renew.
So interesting. So I think before we get into the whole Nechemiah Jennifer, why don't you set the stage a little bit, and another brief but very quickly. The you mentioned a little bit, but the community in Amsterdam, how it started, and between the Sephardim and then the Ashkenazim, and how it was structured.
Sure. Okay, so this we could also spend a semester on. So there were two communities. By the time Chacham Tzvi got to Amsterdam in 1710, there were two communities living, you know, side by side, like, you know, across the canal, as they might say, in Amsterdam, the Sephardim and the Ashkenazim. So the Sephardim were the original community by a long stretch. They had been there already since the beginning of the 17th century, and they were very successful and very prominent. So they had mosdos, meaning they had community institutions. They had a beautiful shul, and they had a beautiful beautiful school and a beautiful yeshiva, and they had their prominent community. Again, you know, mostly these were refugees, either directly or, you know, over the course of generations from the Iberian Peninsula, who had fled and who ended up in Amsterdam. So you fast forward now, you know, that's the beginning of the 17th century. Fast forward to the middle of the 17th century, the 30 Years' War, you know, Chmelnytsky. Things aren't going well for the Jews, the Ashkenazic Jews of Europe, and so much of the Ashkenazic world is in flux, and they're fleeing, and they're penniless, and they're homeless, and a lot of them come to Amsterdam, but they come with nothing, and that creates a difficult dynamic for the existing community. So on the one hand, the Sephardim were very generous, they're very wealthy, and they were very, very generous. And they did whatever they could to support the Ashkenazic Jews from German lands or from Lithuania, wherever they were coming from, to help them, to get them back on their feet. But their generosity only extended so far. So, you know, at some point, it was not comfortable for them, you know, for the Sephardic Jews, or not safe for them. You know, it could jeopardize the whole community if you become a way station for immigrants. You know, what are the authorities going to say? What are the authorities going to do? Is this going to compromise our ability to function as a community, to continue to be successful in trade, and so on? So right away, from the beginning of the establishment of the Ashkenazic community, and Ashkenazic itself is too broad a word, meaning we say Ashkenazic, but there was a German community of refugees, there was a Polish community, and they had their own little distinctions, which were important too. But for the sake of simplicity, you know, right away, you had two very different communities living side by side. So you had the Sephardim, who are old, in the sense that they've been there for many decades, they're established, they're wealthy, they're successful, they're independent. And you have this Ashkenazic community, which is just a bunch of haggard, homeless, penniless refugees, just trying to, you know, make it to tomorrow and keep their families alive. So at some point, they're able to get themselves on their feet a little and establish a community. By the end of the 17th century, they have a shul and they have a community, and they have a rav, and now they're on their feet a little. 1710, they're looking for a new rav, and they hire Chacham Tzvi, but they're living totally in the shadow of their Sephardic brethren.
Right, and that's important, as we'll see in a few minutes. So just to just clarify one more thing about the Sephardim, first of all, they were a community of former Muranos, right?
More exactly. Or less.
And also, yeah, they had a certain interesting structure. Obviously, they had Rabbanim, obviously, Nashu ben Israel, and Rishol Morterda, and the ones that I'm forgetting the other names, Isaac Abo Abda Fonseca, I would pronounce his name. So, but they also, the real power there was the Mamad, so to speak, right? And I explain how, what that was, and how, what was the power structure there?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So the Ma'amad is like the lay board of the community, it's constituted of the powerful lay volunteers who make the decisions, and the decisions are very sweeping, meaning they could decide, you know, what the taxes are for the community. They could decide, you know, where a person gets to sit in the shul. They could decide, you know, who gets to conduct commerce with who. In some communities, the Ma'amad was so powerful, they said, you know, this is our community, and if anybody leaves, they have to keep paying taxes. This is our community, and if somebody wants to marry someone from outside our community, let's say a Sephardic person wants to marry Ashka, they have to have our rishus. They didn't say Rishus, they probably said Rishut. So this is a very powerful institution. And the, you know, the sense that, oh, you know, the Rav just gets to decide or to paskin, not so simple. You know, in London, for instance, the Ma'amad controlled publishing. So the rabbi of the city wanted to publish a book. So the Ma'amad says, we'll decide if you publish the book, it's not up to you. So lots of power rested in the hands of the Ma'amad.
Right. I think the early American communities also were Sephardi, also operated a lot in this way in Philadelphia and New York. But correct me if I'm wrong, did the Ma'amad also have the power to excommunicate, to put people in Cherem as well?
Yeah. That's a very important issue. So it varied from community to community. Again, you know, we think in the Beis Medrash, oh, you know, the Rav decided to put them in Cherem. Sometimes the Rav had no power to put anybody in Cherem, only the Ma'amad, where the Ma'amad said, if you want to put someone in Cherem, you come talk to us and we'll decide. So, functionally, the Ma'amad, you think about, Baruch Spinoza, so it was the Ma'amad that excommunicated Baruch Spinoza.
I don't know if this is true. Am I misremembering? There's instances where the Ma'amad actually put a Rav in Cherem even?
Including Chacham Tzvi.
Right, so we're going to get to that right now. Okay, so we set the stage. He's there, 1710. So 1713, the Nechem Yichayon affair erupts. So who is Nechem Yichayon? And obviously a lot of this, people may be familiar with Elisheva Kalbach's book, based on a dissertation, or Moshe Chagiz, which covers a lot of this material because he was there in Amsterdam at the same time. So, what happened with Moshe Chagiz, Nechem Yirion, Chacham Tzvi? I guess talk about the whole story.
Okay, so we'll see if we can do a condensed version because it's a lot. So maybe just a word about Sabbatianism to put things in perspective. 1665, 1666, we know that the Jewish world is shaken by the revelation that this man called Shabtai Tzvi declares himself to be the Messiah. And really the whole Jewish world is moved by this declaration. People start selling their property and packing up their stuff and changing their tefillos, and they start believing in this movement that Shabtai Tzvi is the Messiah. About a year after he declared his messiahship, he converted to Islam, which for most people ended the dream. And this wave that had begun came to an end, and most people reverted to traditional Judaism with the recognition and the understanding that this was a terrible mistake, and Shabtai Tzvi was not in fact the Messiah. But there were also crypto Sabbateans. So it's hard to paint everyone with one broad brushstroke because there's a lot of points along the spectrum. What does it mean to be a Sabbatian? What does it mean to be a crypto Sabbatian? What does it mean to be a Sabbatian after Shabtai Tzvi convert, after he died, right? 10 years later, he dies, and there's still crypto Sabbatians. So what does it mean to be a crypto Sabbatian? So we could just assume for the sake of this conversation that a crypto Sabbatian is Shomer Shabbos and Shomer Kashrus and Shomer Torah Mitzvos, and they come to shul and they look like everybody else, but when they daven Shmona Esrei, then they start saying "Es Semach David Avdechem Eres Etzmiach." So they're thinking of Shabtai Tzvi. That's their kavanah. So for the better part of all these decades, you know, after the death of Shabtai Tzvi, we don't know the numbers, but there's certainly a not insignificant number of crypto Sabbateans who continue to believe that Shabtai Tzvi was the Messiah. And no one really wants to stir the pot. It was such a devastating episode for the Jewish people that no one wants to cause more machlokes, and no one wants to start unraveling things again. I'll just say as an aside, the one time in Shut Chacham Tzvi that Chacham Tzvi received a question about Sabbateanism, someone once asked him, it's a question from the Ottoman Empire, and they wrote to him and they said, "Can you tell us, we have someone in our community, we want him to be Chassan Torah," apropos this time of year. So we want him to be Chassan Torah. It just happened to be in his personal history, he got swept up with Sabbateans and he was a Sabbatean. But he did tshuva, and now he doesn't believe that anymore. Can he be Chassan Torah? And Chacham Tzvi says, "What do you mean? He did tshuva? Of course he could be, right? It's not like a lifetime stain. People can do tshuva. So he shouldn't have believed it, but everybody got wrapped up in that. It's too bad. But it's past, and if he did tshuva, so he could be a Chassan Torah for sure. It's beautiful." So there wasn't any controversy that we could find or that we could speak of in any meaningful way, by and large, for these years following the apostasy and death of Shabtai Tzvi. So every once in a while, you had someone who showed up and they claimed that Shabtai Tzvi was still Mashiach, and they started a movement. And there are a handful of cases. What happened in 1713 is that a man called Nechemia Fayon arrived in Amsterdam. Nechemia Chayun, before he arrived in Amsterdam, was already on people's radar as something of a troublemaker or something of a problem. He was for a time a rav in Skopje, and that itself is conspicuous because Skopje was the place where Nathan of Gaza was buried, and that had become something of a pilgrimage place for Sabbateans. So it's not coincidental that he was serving as a rav in Skopje. He had also been in Sarajevo, and probably probably Chacham Tzvi knew him from his time in Sarajevo as an unsavory character. In 1713, before he got to Amsterdam, Nehemia Chayun published two books in Berlin. The first was a book of drashos. The first was a book called Divrei Nehemia, book of drashos on the Parsha. Basically a harmless, more or less, if you're really looking, you could find clues, but more or less a harmless book. And in the front of that book, there are a number of haskamos. So most books, many if not most books from this period had haskamos. So haskama means that someone has read the book, they approve of the book, they put like a little copyright and says you shouldn't republish this book for a number of years. And if you have haskamos, like today, so you have haskamos from the big Rosh Yeshiva, so it makes people want to buy the book, it tells people the book is okay, it's kosher. So for Divrei Nehemia, he had solicited a number of haskamos from important rabbanim of the time. So he took his the haskamos from Divrei Nehemia, and he copied them into a second book that he published in Berlin called Oz Leilokim. Oz Leilokim was filled mitzchila b'ad sof with Minus and Apikorsus and Sabadian theology, but he forged the haskamos. So at the front of this book called Oz Leilokim, so you have haskamos from prominent rabbanim, and it looks like they endorse the book. So he shows up in Amsterdam with his books, and he has a Sephardic background. So he goes to the Sephardic Mamad, and he says, "I want to sell my books. I just I'm new here. Just want to get rishus so I could sell the books. The community, everyone should know about them." So somehow Moshe Chagiz, who's an itinerant a rav and a friend of Chacham Tzvi, gets a hold of the book. He gives it to Chacham Tzvi. He says, "I think there's something suspicious here. You want to take a look?" Chacham Tzvi takes a look and he says, "Not just suspicious. This is Sabadian," and he knows all about it from his time in Salonika and his time in the Ottoman Empire. And he says, "You got to kick the guy out of town and you got to burn the book." This precipitates a whole controversy because you'd think, Chacham Tzvi, Gadol Hador, says this book is apikorsus. Somebody's going to argue with him? So the answer is someone is going to argue with him because he's only the Ashkenazic chief rabbi. But the Sephardic community is much more powerful. And so the Sephardic chief rabbi, a man named Solomon Ayalon, says, "Not so fast. We have to check this out." Sof kol sof, it turns out that Solomon Ayalon is himself a crypto-Sabadian and is therefore quite supportive of Nehemia Chayun. He doesn't want to tip his hand and say, "Oh, no, I'm a..." No, it's all very subtle. So he creates a commission of seven supposedly learned individuals to survey the book. So they survey the book and they come out and say, kosher. Not one word of problematic material. Meanwhile, Chacham Tzvi had published, we have it, it's a Kolkari, a broadside. He has chapter and verse, page 2, page 7, page 9, page 11. These are the problematic passages. It's obvious, right, objectively to anyone who reads it, that this is filled with heretical material. But the Ma'amad supported the position of their chief rabbi, the Sephardic chief rabbi. And to make a long story short, this controversy went on for a few months. Chacham Tzvi and Moshe Chagiz enlisted the support of everyone. They was the forerunner to every political campaign and letter writing campaign. They wrote to everyone that they knew, from Smyrna to Constantinople to Northern Africa to Italy to their old friends in Altona, Hamburg, Wandsbek. And they, created, like a nationwide, worldwide cherem for Nehemia Chayun, except the one place where they didn't accept the cherem was in Amsterdam. And in Amsterdam, they sided with Chayun. Moshe Chagiz and Chacham Tzvi had to flee, and the rest is history.
Okay, great. So first of all, they the Mamad and the Sephardim ended up putting Chacham Tzvi and Moshe Chagiz in Cheirim. That caused them to leave, right?
At least one, probably two. Yeah.
Right. Now, the other thing was, the other thing I wanted to ask about the story was, the Mamad was looking at the book and they like smuggled out a copy, and so they were like, they felt like they were undermined or something like that. Is that part of the story, what happened?
So part of the story is that the book was not easy to get. So Chacham Tzvi was shown the book. He had a very short time to see the book and to go through it and identify the issues that were problematic. And then they took the book back. It was only much later that they had to find, for you know, some exorbitant price, that Chacham Tzvi and his camp could find a copy of the book. So meanwhile, you know, Chayun and the Mamad were on fine terms, so they always had the book.
Right, right. So there was a... Okay, I guess we'll leave it to that part of the story. So the fallout was he had to leave. So he went from there to London. Where did he go from there?
Yeah, so Chacham Tzvi had a very nice relationship with the community of London. They had a number of times corresponded a number of occasions. And he had also come to the defense of Chacham David Nieto. David Nieto was, a Talmud Chacham, an important rabbi. He was the rabbi of the community, the Spanish community, the Sephardic community in London, which was the primary community in London. And there was once a controversy that had been a few years earlier where they were probably also some Sabadians, or at the very least some troublemakers, accused David Nieto of being a heretic, which was the most outlandish thing they possibly could have said, except it caused a whole controversy. So they said, what are we going to do? How do we solve this? Let's write to Chacham Tzvi and we'll show him the sermon that was controversial and he'll paskin, and what he says we'll do. So Chacham Tzvi looked at the sermon and he said, kosher, 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 it's not an issue. The whole thing is a tempest in a teapot. And if there's any problem here, it's the people who are causing the controversy, not the Rav. So Chacham Tzvi had a good friend in David Nieto. He traveled from Amsterdam to London and spent a few months in London before traveling east toward Poland.
And people may know Chacham or Rav David Nieto from his Sefer Kuzri Hasheni, Mateh Don. People may be familiar with him from that. So how was his time in London? Was it just quick? Did he speak English, actually? People here speak English. And also, there's some story with his portrait in London.
Yeah. I've often wondered whether Chacham Tzvi spoke English. I think I tracked down that he spoke like 8, 9, 10 languages, you know, that he either, you know, read or spoke, including Arabic and Spanish and Italian. So it would not have been the craziest thing in the world to imagine that he could have spoken English, but I have no evidence that he spoke English. The Sephardic Jews in London themselves may not have even spoken English, meaning the language that they may have spoken to each other might have been Spanish. It's perfectly likely, depending on the generations. So he spent a few months there. Yaakov Emden says that they loved him so much that they wanted him to be their Rav. So it's just a little problematic because David Nieto was the Rav, you know, for many years before and for many years after. So I'm not sure what exactly that meant, but at the very least, they had a very positive impression of Chacham Tzvi and a very warm relationship. The story that Yaakov Emden tells is that the Jewish community in London really loved Chacham Tzvi. They really loved his father. And they wanted to paint a portrait of Chacham Tzvi, but that was like not in the character type of Chacham Tzvi to like sit for a portrait. So he wasn't going to do it. But while he was doing something else, they say there was a painter and the door was open in the room next door, and he started painting, and he ended up painting a portrait of Chacham Tzvi. Yaakov Emden says he saw the portrait many years later. And you have to remember, there wasn't, you know, many many years before photography, and painting was still a luxury and something was expensive. He'd never seen an image of his father. So many years later, he saw this portrait and he said it like rattled him. It shook him to his soul because he thought like, oh my gosh, my father is sitting in front of me, because it was such a spitting image of his father. So today, this this portrait hangs in the Jewish Museum in London. Many copies have been made of it. If you Google, you know, Chacham Tzvi image or something, that's the one image we have of Chacham Tzvi.
Okay, so another question that I wanted to get to was, we've mentioned, referenced a lot, Yaakov Emden and writing Gil Sefer. So do we know, what do we know of his relationship with his father, the Chacham Tzvi?
Yeah, it's a great question. So the first thing to know about the relationship between Yaakov Emden and Chacham Tzvi is that it was very short. Yaakov Emden, we don't know for sure when he was born, but within a year, we could say it was around 1697. He was married in 1715, and after 1715, he never saw his father again. His father only lived a few more years till 1718, but he never saw his father after 1715. So roughly speaking, he had a relationship with his father until he was 18 years old. So it's not as if, we have like correspondence between the Yaibetz and Chacham Tzvi discussing a difficult Tosfos in Yoma. It never happened because he was a kid. Yaakov Emden was a kid by the time he said goodbye to his father. And even if they were corresponding in those final years, his father had passed away. Yaakov Emden was maybe 21. That being said, Yaakov Emden idolized his father. He worshipped his father. As I mentioned a few minutes ago, the first quarter of Yaakov Emden's autobiography is a biography of his father. Right? Ask most people who write autobiographies, it doesn't shake out that way. You know, they say something about their background, about their history, about their family. But Yaakov Emden saw himself in some ways as following in the footsteps of his father, and he held out his father as a role model in many, many ways.
Mm. So a few things just as we kind of wrap up. What are some other interesting things maybe that are in your dissertation that you want to bring up about the Chacham Tzvi? So perhaps I'll suggest maybe are there some interesting halachic disputes that he was involved in, one of the chicken without a heart maybe you want to talk about, and then I'll let you answer that one, and then I'll get to the other part. And maybe the other things you want to bring up.
Sure. So, look, Chacham Tzvi wrote, published 170 tshuvos in his shut, and then there are many more that were not published in his lifetime, either that he didn't include or that were written after he published his shut in 1712. So he has many, many fascinating halachic positions. I think among my balabatim, the one that is most important to them is the Chacham Tzvi's position that if you're a ben chutz laretz and you spend yantif in Eretz Yisrael, so you should keep one day of yantif. So that won him a lot of points in some communities. He was very independent minded. So just because people had said something or had done something for a long time in a certain way, it didn't move him. So the whole world could have said X, and he was perfectly comfortable saying Y if that's what he believed was the MS, if that's what he believed was the halacha. So there was a famous controversy in 1709. A woman who was preparing a chicken discovered that the chicken had no heart. So the chicken had just been shechted, and she sees it has no heart. So is that the halacha in Shulchan Aruch that it's treif, or is it something else? So this precipitated a whole machlokes. And Chacham Tzvi wrote a very, very lengthy series of tshuvos on this question. And he said, it's impossible. A being, a creature, an animal in this world cannot live without a heart. And here's 1,000 rayos from everywhere, from the Zohar and from the Rambam and from the Gemara and from medieval science books, every raya that you could possibly marshal, to defend the position that there's no such thing. You can't be alive in this world without a heart. So if you're telling me this woman found the chicken, so the heart fell out and the cat ate the heart, the heart got lost. It doesn't shtim to say that there's such a thing as a chicken without a heart. So, other poskim said, no, it's treif, you can't eat the chicken. So Chacham Tzvi said, there must be a heart. If you don't see it, it's because it got lost. The chicken is kosher. Trust me. So this was obviously, there's only one chicken riding on this machlokes. You know, how high are the stakes? But, 300 years later, this is arguably the starting point for any conversation that we have bizman hazeh on the debate as to what constitutes the moment of death. Is it brain death, or is it cardio respiratory death, right? And there's so much hanging in the balance, right? This is like, if you look up an Igros Moshe, so how do you begin to have the discussion about where life ends? So it starts with Chacham Tzvi's tshuva on the heartless chicken.
Wow, fascinating. So the other one you mentioned to me something about, he had something about Kabbalah. Chacham Tzvi, is there opinion on that?
Yeah, sure. So this also requires a lot of time. But the short version of the story is Chacham Tzvi was a Kabbalist, right? And when we say that Chacham Tzvi knew something, so it's not like he scratched the surface. He knew everything about it. Also for another topic, one of the major factors that contributed to Chacham Tzvi's Bekiyus was his access to basically every sefer in the world. Because he lived in port cities and cities with big libraries, so you almost never find, basically you never find Chacham Tzvi saying, I didn't have that sefer, so I could... A lot of his contemporaries, and again, this is, I think, a really fascinating and big topic, a lot of his contemporaries, they say all the time, it's like, well, I think this is the answer, but right now, I don't have these farm in front of me, so I know that it's pressing, so I'm sending off my tshuva, but I don't have this farm. I don't have this farm in front of me. Yaakov Reicher, the author of the Shvus Yaakov, so one time he writes, he's like, we just had a fire. I have nothing. I have a shas, and I have an Ein Yaakov. He doesn't have a shulchan. He has nothing. So Chacham Tzvi had everything, right? Because he lives in these amazing communities where he's blessed to have access to everything, including access to all of Kabbalistic literature. That being said, he was quite nervous about people trying to learn Kabbalah on their own and then paskin based on Kabbalistic sources, and he didn't want any piece of it. So he was very careful to say, if there's a debate, if there's an issue, the first place we go is to Shas. If Shas is silent on a particular issue, so then we can have recourse to Kabbalah. But if there's a machlokas between the Gemara and the Zohar, so we follow the Gemara.
I wonder how much Sabbatianism played into that. I assume what was going on, a lot.
For sure, for sure.
So end off, first of all, I know I'm probably going to get asked this, so I'm just going to ask this to you. Is your dissertation available to read? Nowadays, everybody loves to read dissertations, and Yaakov Emden won, a J.J. Schachter has been read by every Shiva guy. So is there something that will be available if people want it, or it doesn't have to be? I'm just curious.
For sure, for sure. So it's on ProQuest. If people have access to ProQuest, then it's available right now. And if somebody wants to read it, I'm more than happy to share with them a PDF. They could just email me. I'm easy to find, ylevine@jewishcenter.org, jewishcenter.com, jewishcenter.org rather as the website, and you'll find me. I'm happy to share it.
Is it something that you would publish as a book down the road?
I would love to. It's not quite there yet. It needs more work to get from dissertation to book. But I would hope one day to be able to publish it.
And last question: is there any further research? Are you researching any other Gdolim or topics at this time?
So the short answer is yes. Always interested in the period more broadly, and some of the issues that came up. I'll tell you one thing that I didn't cover in the dissertation, which is its own form of intellectual history, and that is what academics call reception history. So what was the value and meaning of or standing of Chacham Tzvi in the eyes of poskim that followed him? So do we Paskin like him? Do people always cite him? Do they never cite him? And that's really its own, you know, you'd have to go through, you know, pick your top 10, top 20, top 100 Poskims between 1718 and 2020 to understand how does Chacham Tzvi rate in the world of Achronim, in the world of Gedolei Torah, you know, and what happens, you know, how often do they cite him and Paskin like him? How often do they cite him and not Paskin like him? And I think that's a fascinating topic for future research.
Gotcha. Okay. Very good. Thank you very much for joining me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure.